Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Helen Caldicott and my very special guest today is author Sally Henderson. Sally is an Australian whose passion is conserving endangered African wildlife, particularly elephants. In 1990, she joined the Elephant Research Project in Zimbabwe, which inspired her memoir, Silent Footsteps, published by Pan Macmillan in 2007. She's travelled extensively throughout Africa, studying many aspects of conservation and a diverse array of African cultures. Sally's new book is Ivory Moon, a memoir set in Namibia. Ivory Moon was published in 2009 by Pan Macmillan. And Sally joins us now. Welcome to the program, Sally.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Helen.
Now, Sally, are you in Melbourne?
No, I'm on the Sunshine Coast Queensland.
So tell us how you first got interested in going to Africa
In 1984 was my first visit.
Okay, well, tell us why you went, where you went, and what happened to you.
Well, I guess from childhood, Helen, I've been a little bit of a crusader. You don't know that when you're a child, but
no.
I grew up in a house with a father who was a frustrated vet, so we raised injured wildlife, Australian wildlife, obviously.
He was a vet, was he?
No, he wasn't.
He just didn't become one, yeah, right.
No, he went off to war just as he was about to start, so
yes.
He never was able to fulfil that.
Yeah.
But he did so by, you know, gathering all these poor, unfortunate things, and I had in my bedroom joeys in sugar sacks.
Well,
and,
wait a minute. Explain to the American audience what a joey is, Sally.
Oh, yeah. A joey is a baby kangaroo.
Yeah.
And these were often taken from what we call road kills. The mother had been killed and we would find them in the pouch.
Yeah.
Bring them home and raise them. So I had these little things hopping around my bedroom and into bed with me, and I had birds on the bed, galahs and parrots. And
tell them what a galah is.
A galah is the most beautiful parrot. It's pink and grey.
Yeah.
And I lived in Western Queensland, which is the outback of Australia.
Yeah.
And that's where these birds are. And they used to fall out of the sky, the little fledglings, on their first flight.
Aww.
So I'd raise them. And also reptiles in boxes in the corner. But
Helen, poisonous snakes?
Yes, snakes and fabulous lizards and things. I fed them ants and all sorts of stuff that I discovered would keep them alive. And
yeah.
They were also all injured one way or another.
Yeah.
But my father brought home these books of Africa from the time I can remember. He gave me all the books on the conservationists and the explorers, and I guess I had a call because it was African wildlife that I wanted to work with.
Yeah.
And then that was just an absolute obsession with me. As I think I read somewhere that you had the same thing. You were given a book that got you going.
Yeah.
But I think it's the nature of our beast that we be these sort of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was driven. So finally I got there in 1984 in my early 30s.
Yep.
And on my very second night in Africa, I couldn't believe I was there. You know, I felt I'd come home. I was in the Kalahari Desert in Botswana. And an elephant literally saved my life.
Really? How? What happened?
Well, I was in a tent and a lioness came in and tried to eat me while
into
I
the
was
tent?
My hands. No, outside. But during the night when I got into the tent, I forgot to put the flaps down. I was so excited by being there.
Yeah.
And just had insect screens between me and a pride of lions.
Yeah.
And the pride of lions it was a drought-stricken time. I mean, the Kalahari is a very dry area anyway, but they'd had a five-year drought. So the predators didn't have the prey they needed. And only 2 weeks before, a young German tourist had been dragged from her tent and devoured in front of all the children in the tent.
Oh, my God.
In the same place that I was.
In the same place?
Same place. So they actually thought these could have been the same lions.
Right.
It's aberrant behaviour, but nevertheless, for lions to do such a thing.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it was a very long night. And I suppose about 4 o'clock in the morning.
Did you watch them from? Wait a minute. Did you watch them from your tent for hours? Did they just sit
outside?
Well,
I did, but I didn't dare look them in the eye. You know, I actually had the lion sleeping against the canvas, his body against mine. All that separated us was the canvas.
Oh, hell.
And he was bathing me in his halitosis, and I knew he could see me, and I'd studied enough to know that I must not look him in the eye.
Yeah.
And there were five lionesses as well.
Yeah.
And they began to run and roar around my tent, and I thought, that's it, I'm gone, I'm going to be eaten. And I had visions of Dr. Livingstone and the description of him being in the jaws of a lion. And then this elephant came in, this big bull, and he chased them and stayed with me until dawn.
He came into the camp.
He came in and he just stood there right beside my tent.
Yeah.
And I made him a vow. You know, I'd been calling on everyone that could possibly help me to help me, Buddha, Jesus, Mum, whoever. and this elephant did the job. And they came back in when he left at dawn, and he came straight back, chased them again and stayed until we were quite safe.
Oh, what a darling.
It was an incredible story, really, when I think about it.
Yeah.
Helen, in the years since, I've had so many experiences that are inexplicable there, that I begin to believe what the local people told me. They said that he was actually an elephant, he was the spirit of Africa in the guise of an elephant who'd come to save me because I had work to do.
Well, then you've got to tell us some of your other experiences, Sally.
Well, I just set my mind to going back there and working with elephants, and I set up a conservation body in Australia called Elephriends Australia, and through my effort into that, but I really wanted to be there with hands-on experience. You know, I just had this desperate need. So I did go, and I joined a research project. Now, my discipline's anthropology and archaeology.
Oh, right.
But I just moved the parameters of, you know, observing human behaviour onto observing elephants.
Yeah.
Because it's not so different. We have the same ways of going about our business. And it was just the most extraordinary experience of my life.
All right. Now, you need to describe that to us all and inspire us and stimulate us and get us going.
Well, I suppose it's an unusual thing to do, to uproot. I mean, I divorced my husband because the marriage wasn't so happy and I'd married very young.
Yeah.
So basically, I just changed my life. I turned it upside down in that instant at this place in Botswana
where the
lions had come.
Yeah.
So my life had turned upside down and I was an obsessed person.
Mm.
Get there to Wangi, near Wangi National Park in Zimbabwe. We were doing work with this particular herd of elephants.
Yeah.
And got to know them. And they shared their life with me and with my second husband, Jeremy. And we just lived with them. We picked up our tent and moved when they left an area and put our tent down near them again. So I saw things that are beyond reckoning. Elephants are highly intelligent. They're everything that we hear, highly intelligent, very complex creatures.
Uh-huh.
And I'll avoid being anthropomorphic, but really you do get an enormous connection. You do see human characteristics. And the one I think I found the most endearing was the forgiveness they had for humans who'd gone in there to poach, and then they would still trust us, even though one of their members had been shot.
Mm.
While we were there, Helen, you were speaking of rhinos earlier, every rhino in Wangi National Park was shot during that period.
Oh, my God. What length of time was that?
That was 8 months at first.
Eight months?
In 8 months, we lost this entire population of rhino in Wangi.
How many?
Oh, golly, there would have been 15.
Were they black or white rhinos?
They were all white rhinos, and so they're rather like big steam engines. You know, they're very slow in moving and they can't see very well, so they're just sitting ducks for anyone. But the poachers aren't kind. They sometimes didn't finish them off and they took their horns and left them with youngsters and, oh, my goodness.
And they sell their horns to the Chinese who grind them up for aphrodisiacs, right?
Yes,
isn't
and
that
to the Yemenis for dagger handles.
For dagger needles.
Yeah. So we began to spread the rumour that you'd get AIDS from this.
Oh,
you know,
what a
good
idea.
We did everything we could.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the rhinos are really on their last legs.
Yeah, I think all the white rhinos have gone, have they not, Sally?
No, there's still some. where we were in Namibia, there were the last free, in 2006, the last free roaming elephant rhinos on the planet lived there. I know the numbers, but we won't give them. And that's probably because it's such a hostile, parched environment there that humans really don't even want to go in there and risk dying of thirst to get the horns. But they do have a very strong conservation policy there, so they've got a pretty good anti-poaching brigade.
Well, then let's go back, though, when you went to where were you when with the elephants and had the most amazing experiences?
That was in Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe, yeah.
It was a concession. The elephants actually knew. They lived on a concession beside Wangi National Park.
What's a concession?
Well, it's not actually a national park, but it's a designated area for wildlife.
Uh-huh.
And but they're less protected in a concession than they would be if they were in the park.
Right.
But, of course, Zimbabwe's in crisis, so there's really no one to look after these creatures now.
No, but in those days, you were there in the, what,
Halcyon days, yes,
yeah.
Just after independence.
Yes, so things were much better then. Were they being protected then?
Oh, yes, pretty well, but poaching was just rampant still. Poachers used to come in from Zambia, which was impoverished. It was on its knees at that time. And there was a policy then to shoot poachers on sight. Now, I don't know that I agree with that, but that was in some way maintaining some sort of equilibrium. But they still came in, and they had AK-47s. They'd just mow them down, and we'd hear them. We were in our tent. And we'd hear this at night. And our allies are in danger, obviously, because we were there to protect them.
So and then how did they cut their trunks off? With chainsaws or?
Their tusks?
Yeah.
Tusks. They didn't. They couldn't afford chainsaws, so it would be some sort of, you know, just a little handsaw. And then they'd escape, get out and take that back over the border.
And who do they sell this to, this ivory?
Well, that's a pretty vexing point.
Yeah.
In Zimbabwe, we know for sure that it was a government body was quite happily buying these and selling them on and making a lot of money. You know, it's the man up top that they never catch.
Mugabe?
Well, yes.
And then to whom are they then sold? To?
Well, to the Chinese or the Yemenis, anyone who wants them.
And then they're turned into, what, ivory keys and jewellery and...
Oh, it's disgusting. And yes, piano keys and things, yes. So rather than having them floating around beautifully on the living animal, there they are for all time,
and
you know, sitting on a desk.
Sally, I'm interviewing Sally Henderson, who is actually an anthropologist but has devoted much of her life to elephants. In this concession area in Zimbabwe, then, how many elephants were there, Sally?
We had at that time maybe 180. Very hard to count elephants in that herd. And to protect them, we approached President Mugabe and asked if we could call them the presidential herd.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, we thought it was a good idea,
Helen. Appealing to his ego, yes. I've met him.
Yeah,
you
well,
know.
That's right.
Yes.
And it worked for a little while. At that time, you know, he was good old Bob. He was the great hope of Zimbabwe in southern Africa, and people really thought he was going to do this, but of course power corrupts completely, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
And in the years since, we've seen what's happened there, and no, he hasn't protected the presidential herd. Jeremy and I went back in 2006 for a reunion, and that was a little bit dicey because I was just finishing Silent Footsteps, and I had written quite clearly and with great conviction about what I'd seen and about the regime there, and I had to get out. I could only stay 3 weeks. I began to realise my life was in danger. But what we discovered was the dreadful human tragedy, obviously. Our friends, so many had died, and the elephants, of course, had been decimated in the worst sort of way. And yet, Helen, getting back to just elephants and the beauty of them, I was recognised by... I had been back many times between, but I was recognised by the cows that I knew well, and they came to greet me, and even stroked my face with her trunk and blew in my face, and both of us cried.
Oh, what, the elephant cried too?
Yes.
Well, now tell us, I want you to tell us more stories about how wonderful they are, and I don't mind a bit of anthropomorphic equation, as you're describing their behaviour. We want to know about elephants.
All right. Well, perhaps if I tell you there was a matriarch called Skewtusk there, mm. who possibly was the main matriarch of that herd of 180.
Mm.
And she was a feisty old girl.
Mm.
But eventually she accepted Jeremy and I quite well. And then in the end, she actually included us in what was going on. And one particular day, the entire herd were on the savannah, and we were there with them. We always tried to get there before them so we didn't disturb them.
How did you get there? Did you have
a car?
You had a car, yeah.
Yep, mm. and they knew us.
Mm.
They'd come up, and in fact, one old bull named Rembrandt used to come and put his tusk either side of the back of the vehicle and then rest his trunk along the top of the vehicle and go to sleep. But this day we were on the savannah just enjoying them, and I was busy, you know, doing what I had to do in identifying various elephants and taking lots of photographs. And they froze. They just froze. 180 elephants stopped still. And I'd experienced it only once before, but I felt in my chest this incredible throbbing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I looked at the elephants, the area above the eyes, I suppose the fontanel area, was quivering, and I'd seen this before. So I knew there was communication, low-frequency sound wave communication going on, and they were being told something.
Yeah.
Then they turned and they stampeded in absolute panic with their tails in the air screaming in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just there thinking, my God, what's happened?
Yeah.
At the last moment, Skewtusk turned around and screamed at Jeremy and I, come, come. She was definitely saying, beware, beware, but we didn't know what. And the next day, we of course were very disturbed, and we couldn't find out. Until the next day, we discovered that 11 kilometres away, a bull had been shot by poachers at that time, at that moment. And I presume when he went down, he sent out this fear message, told them all to, you know, gap it, as they say there, to stampede away and hide in the forest. And she included us. She said, come, let's get away from these horrible human people who do this stuff. And a week later, they stayed in the forest for a week. They came out, and they came up to us and surrounded us. And I thought that was forgiveness, forgiveness of our kind. They never once blamed us, humans, like the other humans, for what had happened. And I thought, if that happened here, if an elephant came in and killed a child or, you know, someone, we'd be out there, wouldn't we, with guns, shooting that elephant and getting rid of it and making them all pay.
Mm.
So they have this concept for forgiveness, but they also have a concept, they've got the possibility for great tenderness and they express joy. And when I'm with them, I probably am a little like you to this extent that I worry a lot about the world and the planet and what's happening. So there's always me thinking about tomorrow and what can I do about it, not that I can do very much, or regretting the past or something.
Mm.
When I'm with elephants, I don't do any of that. I'm in the moment.
Mm.
And what they've taught me is, and other wildlife, and African humans, that they're in the moment totally and completely, fully present there.
Mm.
It's a bit like the old Buddhist concept of chop wood and boil water.
Mm.
Whatever you're doing, you do it totally,
mm.
and you don't have other thoughts in your head.
Mm.
And that's what the wilderness in Africa does for me.
Well, it's interesting. That reminds me of the story you told when you were a little girl growing up with the Aboriginals in Australia, and how they, at one point, the whole tribe went into a kind of grief-stricken mourning state, and you
yes.
didn't know why. Do you want to expand on that story, Sally Henderson?
Yeah, well, that was just the beginning of it. I realised then there was more than we know, and I wonder now if technology hasn't sort of obscured this possibility enough.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little girl, went down to play with my friends in their camp. This was in the Northern Territory, the true outback of Australia.
Mm.
And when I ran into camp, the women were sitting keening and the men were in great grief. They were all looking in one direction and the children were huddled in fear, and I knew this was not for me. I raced back to this big homestead and told the manager what I'd seen, and he said, ah, we'll find out.
Mm.
They know before we do. Something's happened.
Mm.
And what had happened was, the next day he went down to tell them that this stockman Aboriginal stockman who'd been riding the fences, checking the wire, checking the boreholes, had got lost and he dug a hole to try and find water and he died. And when he came to tell them, I was creeping along behind, they were already through that initial grieving process. They were burning his gunya and he was gone and they were getting on with life. They knew at the moment, they did their grieving, and when they were told, it was old news.
So you would then extrapolate that to the elephants who knew that one of their tribe had been killed without having any objective evidence at all?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I've seen it in the African people as well. They know when you're coming. They know
days before you're coming,
even though no one said. And they have a capacity for thought that we've lost, I think.
Yes, well, I also know I live on the coast of Australia, and I, in the days gone past, Aboriginals could call the dolphins in, and they would come into shore. They had some sort of communication with the sea life that, of course, we have no idea about.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, there's so many animals that have capacity for these things.
Now, tell us about the joy that the elephants show. How do they express the joy, Sally Henderson?
Oh, look, they almost laugh, you know. I've seen them when they're just having a wild time, when the times are good and they're full of food and they can take time to play, and they do, and the little ones are just superb. They really have fun. They play ring-a-ring-a-rosy, clamber all over each other, and their mothers are very tolerant, and you can see them standing there watching their children and thinking, oh, isn't this wonderful?
One day.
I saw a little girl, perhaps about 2 years old, you see I'm speaking very anthropomorphically here, a young calf, and she didn't know yet how to suck water into her trunk to then drink in her mouth, to put it in her mouth. And she was watching her elders all standing along the water hole having their drink, and they suck it up and then they tip their trunk into their mouth and swallow, and it sounds like a toilet flushing. And she was thinking, now what am I going to do here? And there's little trunks going round and round in circles, and she's watching and putting a trunk in mummy's mouth. And then she decided to give it a go. So she stuck a trunk in the water and tried and tried, and then finally she succeeded, but she didn't know how to block off her sinuses. So it must have gone straight in, and she got such a shock, and she was screaming and crying, and her mother was laughing. But her mother went up and did what they do, stroked her with her trunk, that magnificent piece of equipment, along the back, tucked her in underneath, and pushed her to the breast to feed.
Oh, now how long do they breastfeed elephants?
Oh, for a long time.
What,
years? It's over a year, over a year.
Yeah.
But the little ones test the mother, whatever their mother's eating, by putting their trunks in their mouth, and bit by bit they learn what they can eat and what's good. Just like our children, but they actually breastfeed for a long time.
And you're going
they can go up to 5 years, Helen. It depends on mother and her capacity for patience.
And you were going to say about the size of the breasts, Sally.
Oh, well, they look incredibly like human breasts. And they must be called that. They're unlike other animals that all carry their milk sacs at the back, don't they?
Yeah.
The elephants have them between their front legs.
Oh.
So, and little ones coil their trunks away and suckle. Mm.
Now, I read somewhere when I first wrote If You Love This Planet in 91 that the only other creatures to have menopause are elephants apart from us. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't know. Mm. I've never even thought of that. I know that they actually stop breeding, so I presume that's the case.
Yeah. How long would an average elephant live?
Much the same as us, if it has a good life.
Really?
So up to 70.
Oh, really?
Mm. But they don't have a wonderful life. But in zoos, possibly, where they need taken care of, they live very long lives.
And tell us about the famous elephant memory, because I've always said my young son has a memory like an elephant. He forgets nothing.
Yes, they do have that. Mm. When we went back in 2006, before we went to Namibia, I came into this one spot where I used to spend a lot of time with them. I hadn't been able to find them.
Yeah.
And suddenly they emerged from the bush and I was in an open jeep.
Uh-huh.
So you're completely exposed. And I had complete trust, which I think they sense anyway. And I didn't know, and I looked and looked, and I recognised one girl, one cow. Mm. And I couldn't believe it. I hadn't seen her for maybe 10 years. And she came charging straight towards the vehicle to have a look at who was there. And then she took a double take, stood back, and she shrieked and came very, very close and almost bent down. And she reached out her trunk. I would never touch a wild animal if they wished to touch you. But I suppose it could have been incredibly dangerous because that trunk could just kill you with one hit. But she reached out and she blew into my face and stroked my face. Yeah.
Oh, lovely things.
So she remembered me after all that time.
Yeah. Now, how do they laugh? Do they really laugh?
Oh, look, I'm sure they laugh. They have a particular sound. It's, the rumble is... They actually break that rumble up as if they're going, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah.
And they show you in every aspect of what their body is saying. They're saying, I'm so happy and isn't this fun?
Oh, lovely things. Well, now, tell us about your last trip then to Namibia. Why did you go there? Tell us about the area, how wild it is and what you saw there and how there's not much water except for the fogs that come off the Atlantic and how the animals survive and what happened to you.
Well, after I was in Zimbabwe for that time visiting the elephants in 2006 and human friends, I was absolutely shattered because of what I'd found there. And I really wanted to find a pristine wilderness where humans had no impact. And the only place I could think of, I hadn't been to this particular place, but I had been to the Namib Desert in Namibia. And we volunteered to work and run a safari camp because that was the only way we could stay if we got a work permit, because it is a protected zone. So we went to this very forbidding place, and it was magnificent, austere, raw, parched. It was all of those things, but it was far more remote and isolated and terrifying than I'd ever imagined. But there were the desert elephants and the rhinos and the wildlife that can survive in the desert. How it survived there, our camp was 45 kilometres as the vulture flies from the Atlantic Ocean. And the Atlantic Ocean in Namibia is absolutely the most violent sea I've ever seen. Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, there you are on a latitude that's really quite warm, in fact, very hot, and you've got seals coming up because the sea is very cold. The Benguela current sweeps up from the Antarctic. And that produces this immense fog every day. And at night, that fog comes right inland up to 50 kilometres, and it brings moisture. It brings life to the desert. So desert elephants can't exist on that. They take from the riverbed where there has been a flow of water maybe 3 years before, and they dig sea poles with their tusks, and baboons and other creatures benefit from that. But otherwise, the creatures take their moisture from leaves and grass. Yeah, it's amazing.
You described the baboons. I mean, it sounds absolutely like paradise in a way. I know as scary as you describe it, but probably one of the last places on earth where the animals are undaunted, unthreatened, and free. Would that, do you think that's right, Sally?
Absolutely right. The elephants have a hard life, and they look different from the elephants in the rest of Africa. They're the same species, but they're desert adapted over the millennia. So they've got very long legs, big flat feet. They look thin, and possibly because they never get quite enough food. Mm. And they spend their lives just traversing this incredible dunes and up and down the riverbed seeking food. So they're not gregarious because they don't have time to be. And I had one magnificent cow called Clarissa who lived in our area, and I used to spend a lot of time with her. She had two calves. She still had time for play and joy with her children. And I marvelled at that, because life was tough for them.
Mm. And so how long did you stay in this camp in Namibia, Sally Henderson?
Well, we could only stay for 3 months. That was the time limit. But it seemed like a lifetime. It was just superb. Also very, very difficult. There's nothing romantic about it at all. But it is just extraordinary.
I guess it gets into your blood, does it, and your bones?
Yeah, well, they say if you drink the waters of the Zambezi, you're done. You're going to be going back again and again. And I drank them on my first day in Africa, so I really have been hooked.
When are you going back?
Well, I'm hoping to go very soon. I've been a little busy with the books in the last 2 years. So it'll be a spur of the moment decision. It always is for me. But I want to go back and visit the wonderful people there. You know, we had the Himba tribe and the Yohansi Bushmen living in the area. Mm. We made friends with these people and with the fellows who worked in our camp. And I want to visit
Clarissa. And describe those people.
Well, the very first Himba woman I saw was on my way into this camp. And that was a 17-hour drive and then into darkness. Mm. So I sort of arrived in darkness and had no idea where I was. Halfway through that trip, we had to stop to get stores at the final store, which was 7 hours from camp. So if you wanted to buy a bottle of milk or some eggs, it was a 7-hour trip. And I was standing trying to communicate with this rather wonderful butcher who didn't speak English about what we needed. And I felt something soft rest on my arm. And I looked, and it was a banana-shaped breast painted orange. And I looked up and up and up into the magnificent, serene face of a Himba woman. Mm. And they wear very few clothes. They're totally unselfconscious, and they live a very traditional life and want to. Mm. But I also met many Bushmen. Now, they call themselves that. It's considered to be a name that we shouldn't use, but if we're going to break it up, they were the Yohansi Bushmen in the Nyai Nyai area of Namibia. And I spent time with them, and they are the sweetest people.
Mm.
And they also are desperately trying to hold on to their traditional life.
Mm.
And, yeah, there are a lot of other tribes there as well. And, you know, it's the only place I've been in Africa, Helen, where they actually live in harmony together.
Oh, the tribes, they don't.
The tribes don't seem to have this warring concept. They actually all get on, and they are very different people, and they have different languages.
I wonder if much of Africa was like that in the populations before white people ever trespassed on the land.
Oh, I think we have a lot to answer for.
Oh, I do too.
There's reverse apartheid in Namibia now.
Yeah.
As there is in Zimbabwe, as we can see with Robert Mugabe. So that now we've got the tribal peoples, and it's their land.
Yes.
Making it difficult for the white people who live there.
Yep.
And some of those white people are very angry because they say they've been there for, you know, perhaps 150 years.
Yeah.
And some of the tribes who went in have only been there for that length of time. But I actually totally understand.
Oh, so do I.
Mm.
But the other thing about Namibia, of course, is it's full of uranium. I know the South Africans were there mining it, and the huge corporations. It's got diamonds. It's got God knows what. It's kind of like Australia. And, you know, it's being exploited most harshly by Caucasians.
Oh, yes. And by mining companies.
And mining, well, yeah, same thing. Look, Sally Henderson is an anthropologist who's just written this wonderful book called Ivory Moon about her stay in Namibia, which is quite startling. And another book called, Silent Footsteps, that she wrote only 2 years ago. You've been very prolific, Sally.
Yes, I'm a little tired at the moment.
I can imagine. I understand the feeling. Now, let's get on. What I really want to know is, what is happening to the elephants in Africa? I know there are two species, Indian elephants and African elephants, but what is happening to the population of African elephants at this time, Sally Henderson?
Well, we're hoping it's maintaining. It's very low. There was a count done, I think, in 1996, and there hasn't really been one since. And that was about, I suppose, 500,000 that were left.
What do you think the count was originally?
Oh, Helen, can you imagine? They were everywhere. There would have been so many millions of them.
Oh, really?
And actually, they went down to critical levels at the beginning of the last century, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, when hunters were just going in and absolutely destroying
them. Decimating them. Yeah, I do not understand these white men who like to kill things.
I find it very difficult.
Hang their heads on their walls and say, you know, when I was in, you know, Zimbabwe, you know, in the 1940s, I killed that one and I killed that one. It's the most strange mentality. And
it's beyond me. Yeah. I had quite a few guests come into camp who were hunters.
Yeah.
Now there is some, good going on.
Yeah.
In communal areas with hunting.
Tell us.
There is some hunting. I can't understand it. I never will. But I can stand back and observe and say yes. If the living animal is allowed to grow and become a very old animal in a communal area where people are living,
yeah,
and trying to sustain an existence, and they let people come in and take photos of them, tourists, you know, for 40 years, and then in the end that bull is shot by a hunter and it brings in $100,000 to that community, it gives the people the desire to keep the creatures alive and to propagate more, because they know that they're going to make a lot of money out of the living animal. And then when he is old and dies, they're going to get some more, but not until he's old.
Well, why do they get paid for killing it, allowing an animal to be killed? What happens?
Well, now that is a government policy that actually does make sense in Namibia, because that animal is worth a lot of money as he's an old fellow and he's going to die. So why not let the people in these conservancies and communal areas make the money out of the old fellow?
But
and meanwhile, they've been keeping growing lots of youngsters.
How do they make money out of a dead elephant?
Because the hunter has had to pay this huge amount of money to kill it.
Oh, I see. That's a contract they have.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
So I know, too, that with habitat destruction and the population increasing and the elephants aren't getting enough to eat in many areas of Africa, and then they rage and rampage into villages and destroy crops and the like. Did you see anything of that, Sally Henderson?
No, but I certainly knew of it when I was there. And that was in areas with a very dense human population where they're trying to sustain life. And the message that people are getting across to them, or trying to, is go for ecotourism.
Yeah.
Don't try to feed your people with, you know, miserable little shambles where there's never quite enough food.
Yeah.
And the population is expanding and expanding despite AIDS and other diseases. I think the elephants and the other creatures that come in and attack them and take the crops are just really overwhelmed by humanity.
Oh, obviously. Obviously. And let's talk about rhinos. I know there are white rhinos and black rhinos. What are their populations now down to in Africa?
Oh, shocking. Unbelievably low, Helen. I can't give you the specific figures right now, but, you know, we're talking in the low thousands with white rhinos. Black rhinos are even more threatened.
I think they're extinct.
Are still a few white rhinos. They've been reintroduced into various national parks across Africa. But, you know, they have to have guards walking with them, with machine guns. So is that a life? Whereas actually in Namibia, in the Namib Desert, these creatures do roam free. And I had the bliss of seeing these magnificent animals going about their business. I would always keep well away if I came upon one, because you don't want to disturb them anymore. But they're there,
yeah,
and their numbers are growing, and that's so good. But really, they're almost to the point of extinction, you're right.
Now, what about lions? There's a lovely story of you watched a family of lions and the cubs playing and licking each other and playing with the mother, just like cats. Do you want to describe that scene?
Yeah, well, that was quite an evening, that one. My husband and I, on top of the vehicle we had.
Mm-hmm.
We had a tent on top. And we decided not to put the tent up and just lie there, because the full moon would rise that night. And we'd had quite an evening the night before with elephants sort of rampaging around the place. And my husband woke me with a very strong grip, just put his finger to his mouth and said, look, I looked down over the side of this, you know, sort of camper van thing. And so 16, I think, lions. Were down below. This has happened more than once to me, but this was just extremely spectacular this evening, because you could see them clearly with the full moon.
Mm.
And they were so beautiful. They saw us. They knew we were there. They could have jumped up and done horrible things, but they didn't have any desire to eat us.
Mm.
And we watched this rather wonderful, indulgent father and his little cubs, and they were playing with his mouth and pulling his tail, and he was just accepting all of this so wonderfully. In fact, you know, male lions will let their cubs come in to the kill to eat. They won't let the females, but so there's some sensation of caring for the little ones from the big males. And I suppose we watched for a couple of hours as they played and romped about, and lions are active at night because that's when they hunt. They sleep all day. Mm. And then some of them peeled away to obviously hunt. And sometime later, and another lioness took all the cubs in the opposite direction so they wouldn't disturb the hunt. Mm. Sometime later, we heard the roars of the kill, and they all departed and had their feed.
Mm.
But that was just magical.
And tell me, Sally, are lions threatened in Africa?
Yes, they are, most definitely. I think the only big cat that isn't possibly totally threatened is the leopard.
Why?
Well, because they're nocturnal and they're very cunning and sly and, you could say, very smart.
Did you see any leopards?
Yes, I had an experience that I write about in Ivory Moon with a leopard. My quest is just a little side quest, is to find brown hyenas.
Yes.
And my husband and I made this rather outrageous plan this night to go and sit in this gorge not too far from our camp and sit over a hyena latrine. In other words, a pile of hyena poo, because they all come and do their business in the one spot, so it's a midden.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, if I'm going to see a brown hyena, that's where I will, in the night, though, because they are nocturnal. And we were shivering, and it was freezing. It was -4 degrees, and beginning to get a little bit tired of this when we heard a lion roar.
Mm.
And we'd seen what seemed to be a hyena slope past, but we thought perhaps it wasn't a brown hyena, but a spotted hyena. And we said, look, it's time to go. And with that, another creature came across the path below, perhaps 10 metres from us. And the moon just shone a great blast down onto it at that moment, and it was a leopard.
Mm.
Now, leopards are the only predators, the only cats that kill for fun.
Oh, really?
They don't, yeah.
Like
ordinary cats. They'll play and play with their... But they'll actually go into a herd of springbok when they're lambing, and they'll just kill masses.
Really?
And maybe only eat two.
Oh.
So they're a little different. And they're very, very terrifying animals. And their gaze is malevolent. I kid you not, they're very beautiful.
Mm.
But they look at you with this look that's... So this leopard, of course, could see us. And we knew we were in big trouble.
Because it could leap easily up onto the car.
Well, we weren't in the car. We were on foot.
Oh, you're on foot?
Yeah. And we'd walked, you know, 700 paces from camp to this spot. We had no weapon, obviously, and even if we did, I probably would have died rather than use it.
Yeah.
And the leopard had just one leap and it had it.
Yep.
And what they do is they leap on your back and then come around and rake the stomach and sink their jaws into your throat and strangle you. So I had this vision. But I remembered in past dealings with lions that if we stood up together, like a great big creature, and made primeval sound,
mm.
we had a hope. So we did that.
Mm.
We stood up and we roared and yelled and growled, and it left.
Mm.
But we walked backwards, which was quite a job, all the way until we got to the first tent. And we thought, we can turn around safely now and go to the dining tent and get some hot tea. We turned around and we heard this sort of grumble, growl, and turned back and it was following.
Oh.
But it was an extraordinary leopard. I think actually it didn't know what humans were. It seemed very curious. And it sat down and licked itself and cleaned itself as we turned immediately to face it again, because you never turn your back on a leopard.
Right.
Or a predator.
So you walked backwards, so you didn't see it following you till you turned it to go into the kitchen tent and left your gaze, and then you saw it had been following you.
Yes, it had, but it actually must have been well back,
yeah.
because I can assure you we were looking
hiding
back over
in the
our
shadows,
shoulders.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that was pretty miraculous, really. I used to wander around this camp. There were vast, marvellous dunes in front and great ramparts at the side, if you sort of think of Ethiopia. And surely there must have been a lot of leopards living in there.
Yeah.
But I hadn't seen one. I possibly hadn't taken it into my head. I knew there were lions. But I often prowled, you know, the area, exploring and just generally having this blissful, peaceful time. I was pretty careful thereafter.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it's. I mean, do the Africans themselves, do they experience many attacks by the big cats?
Yes, they do. Leopards actually take quite a few people in Africa.
Oh.
Mm. Lions, not so many. Lions, you can bluff a little bit. I've met lions often walking in Africa, And it's a very terrifying experience. There's no doubt about it. I mean, your heart leaps out of your mouth and you think you're going to die. But if you face them and don't ever run or turn, usually people are all right.
Mm.
But with leopards, it's a very different story. I've got a bushman friend there. He's called Half Ear because he only has half an ear. And how that came about was he was walking with his grandson in an area that was just absolutely romping with leopards. And he wasn't thinking. And a leopard came and charged them. And the grandson actually got his grandfather away, came back to their village. And when grandmother found out what had happened and that grandfather had been roaming in leopard country, she jumped upon him and bit off his ear.
She did?
She did. Not the leopard.
The wife?
Yeah, the wife, the grandmother. They played it out for me. And they were giggling and laughing and rolling around in the sand. It had become one of their stories that they tell around the fire.
Oh, my God.
And he only had half an ear, thanks to his wife. But he didn't leave her. He stayed living with her.
Oh, well, he probably knew he deserved it because
I think so.
Because the grandson could have been eaten.
That's right.
And then, so finally, we know about overpopulation, Sally. In the year 1800, there were only 1 billion human beings. There are now nearly 7 billion, and a lot of that is occurring in Africa. Despite AIDS, partly because of the Catholic Church, partly because of the Bush administration, partly because of poverty, partly because of illiteracy of the women. And clearly we are the pathogens, really, the microbes or macrobes on the planet, destroying other species in our wake. Have you thought about the animals from that aspect, Sally Henderson, as an anthropologist?
Yes, I have.
Yes.
Yeah, we're the supreme predator.
Yeah.
People have asked me, are you frightened of the wildlife? I have enormous respect for the wildlife, and yes, I have fear every now and then, but it's only when I've created a situation, Helen.
Yeah.
They haven't come after me.
No.
I've done something stupid.
Yeah.
It's the human element that I fear. I fear it all the time when I'm in Africa, not because these people are horrendous. They're not. In fact, tribal people are beautiful out of the cities and where there's not extreme poverty, where they're living their traditional life.
Yeah.
But it's the poachers who are being paid often by white men to do this thing, who will kill, and they will kill without a second thought. The other creature I fear, I do fear one creature, is the mosquito. I tell you what, Bill Gates is doing a fabulous job.
With malaria.
Oh, yes. Malaria is, you know, AIDS, there's so much work being done by celebrities and so
on
and such.
AIDS, yeah.
But malaria, because it doesn't kill us, it doesn't kill the rich and, you know, the first world people so much, is greatly overlooked. And I really take my hat off to Melissa and Bill Gates. They're fabulous.
They're giving people mosquito tents for their babies.
Oh, and they're paying, you know, billions for research to see if they can find
it. How many people a year die of malaria, Sally?
Well, it's over a million.
Yeah. And the worst thing is that falciparum malaria or cerebral malaria. When people get that, that's just dreadful.
Yes, I've lost friends.
Have you?
And it's 24 hours. You know, they can get up one morning, so I've got a bit of a headache, and they're dead the next morning.
Oh my God!
It's a dreadful thing.
Yes.
Mm.
Well, I don't.
I had malaria there. I can tell you, it's one of those diseases that makes you say, "Please, please, I want to die now."
Yeah, like bad flu.
Oh. Shocking.
Well, I don't think we'll ever eradicate it, but we can. There are many preventative measures now.
Oh, and the tragedy in places like Africa and India and Asia, where people and South America, is that they can't even afford
the drugs,
the medical requirements to save their children.
Yes, and the other thing, Sally, is that the pharmaceutical companies like making things for people who are shy. What's it called? Social disorder or something, and for people who are depressed, or you know, for white rich people, whether or Viagra, whereas they won't spend the money caring for the most severe diseases in the world: malaria, tuberculosis, and the like.
Yes, and in Africa, dysentery and gastritis—a simple disease. Like we support a village in Zimbabwe, and I can't tell you the number of little ones who die of gastritis.
Oh, yeah.
Simply because the parents can't afford hydrating salt, Helen.
It's
just terrible.
Yeah, gastroenteritis. Mm. Well, there's a lot of work to be done from a global perspective in preventing medicine for the humans, let alone for the animals. And Sally, we've reached the end of our time, and I want to thank you so much for a wonderful, inspiring, stimulating, exciting interview.
Oh, it's been such a privilege to talk with you, Helen. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sally. My guest today was Sally Henderson, an Australian author who's committed to conserving endangered African wildlife. Her latest book is Ivory Moon, a memoir set in Namibia, where she and her husband ran a remote safari camp. Ivory Moon is published by Pan Macmillan and can be found at panmacmillan.com.au. You can also go to Sally Henderson's site at sallyhenderson.com.au. That track was Careless, performed by Renee Geyer. The subject of Robert Mugabe came up in Sally Henderson's interview, and I implied that I met him. I was invited to a conference by Mahathir, Prime Minister Mahathir of Malaysia, and we were in the first formal cocktail party dinner. And standing around chatting, and Bob Hawke, the former Prime Minister of Australia, was there and other such notables. And suddenly into the room came these huge bodyguards, and in the midst of whom was Robert Mugabe. And Bob Hawke said to me, I can't believe this man's here. And he sat opposite Mugabe at dinner. He was so seated. And it was really quite freaky. And he's an old friend of Mahathir. They were close when Mugabe first became Prime Minister of Zimbabwe, when he was seemed to be a pretty good fellow. But the slaughter that's gone on since then in Zimbabwe has been absolutely horrendous. And then finally we found out that Mugabe was going to give the lunchtime talk on Friday, just before you all departed. And all of the speakers who'd been invited to this conference ganged up, and Bob Hawke and I went as representatives to speak to Prime Minister Mahathir and say, if Mugabe speaks, we will all leave beforehand. In the end, Mugabe did not speak, but it was quite a kind of horrifying experience. So that's my story of meeting Prime Minister Mugabe. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll talk with you next week.
Listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.